Good afternoon, and thank you for coming today. So I'm Diana Romero. I'm also at City University of New York, the School of Public Health at Hunter College. And my presentation is about U.S. policy, poverty policy that has utilized fertility prevention to deal with poverty. I don't have any financial relationships to disclose. So I'm going to give a fairly quick background and then go over some data for some research that we've conducted. So first, with regard to welfare reform, which is the last major poverty-related policy that we undertook, this slide shows clearly that it took about, more than 60 years for major welfare related policy to be enacted in this country, and that was about 15 years ago with the Personal Responsibility Act in 1996. While I imagine just about everyone in this room is probably familiar, even though it's been about 15 years, familiar with some of the key elements of that legislation that were more income-oriented and work-oriented. The last bullet on this slide shows that there were also additional aspects of the policy that had to do with sexual and reproductive related behaviors. So if I could just ask by a show of hands, how many people feel that they know what the family cap policy is? No, one person. So that's very interesting. Firstly, I won't be wasting too much of our time, and also it does point to, I guess, what I consider an identity crisis with regard to this policy, the fact that I'm here, a public health professional, at a public health conference talking about a poverty-related policy that is, in my mind, very fundamentally a public health issue, and yet when I go to poverty and welfare-related conferences, there's no discussion about this component of, the largest piece of welfare legislation that we've had in this country. So the family cap. What that is, it's also been referred to as the child exclusion policy, but really family cap is the term out there. It's the ability of states to elect not to provide any additional cash assistance to poor women who are receiving welfare or TANF if they have an additional child. If they become pregnant and have a child after receiving cash assistance, they don't get any additional income or cash grant. And that is a 180-degree switch from what was the case prior to welfare reform, where the amount of cash grant that someone who lived below the federal poverty level was eligible for was based on not only their income, but also the size of their household. So in effect, it's viewed as a penalty disincentive to have children. Some research has already or showed quite some time ago that the states most likely to adopt this family cap policy were states that had relatively higher proportions of African American and Latino individuals in their welfare caseloads, pointing to a racial component of the policy. So about half of the states in the country adopted the policy, as you can see up there, 24. And while that's changed a little bit, it's still the lion's share of those states still currently have the policy in place. So some research that Medina Janor and I conducted and reported not too long ago had to do with asking two questions, an empirical question regarding the policy, essentially, is it effective? Has it been effective? Does it work if people want it to work? And we also asked another question in terms of its ethical use or application. So the first question, very quickly, prior to federal welfare reform, states were able to adopt certain policies that deviated from what essentially was allowed up until the mid-1990s, and New Jersey and Arkansas were the first two states to adopt this policy in the very early 1990s. A condition of doing so was that it had to be administered in an experimental design, so some people were subject to the policy and others weren't, and as you can see very quickly there, Arkansas, there was no reported effect of the policy in terms of the different reproductive-related outcomes that they looked at, and in New Jersey, it would have been concluded to have worked in three out of the four major outcomes. It was associated with an increased use in contraception among poor women, decrease in pregnancies, decrease in births, but it was also associated with an increase in abortion, which made a conservative congressman in the state very unhappy and call for its repeal. but it's still in place. It didn't work. So another part of what we did was also look at non-experimental studies that tried to assess whether the family cap was working or not. Was it effective in decreasing births among poor women? And this is just a quick list of some of the papers we reviewed and the papers out there. Not much has been done, and in just about all these cases, the family cap policy was not a primary objective of these analyses, but it was included among other outcomes that were looked at around changes in welfare policy. The focus might have been on work participation rates or declines of the welfare roles, and they may have also looked at reproduction as well. And for the most part, a review of the limited literature out there on the family cap showed that, firstly, that very few formal evaluations of this policy have been undertaken. The majority of them showed that there was no, there didn't appear to be any effect of the policy on reproduction among poor women. Even some of those studies weren't measuring key variables, for instance, welfare participation. They were economic models that had proxies, or they modeled the likelihood of welfare participation, for example, a woman's completion or not of high school and whether she was a single parent, but they didn't directly measure whether they were even in the welfare system. So the design of some of these studies is somewhat questionable. But we came away feeling that there really was no evidence to support whether that the policy to date had been effective. So then we turned in a public health more framework. We considered whether the policy would be viewed as a just policy, given the social justice orientation of our field. And so we looked at human and reproductive rights documents. This slide here shows the 8 international covenants that we identified as being pertinent, or that we thought would have relevance to the family cap policy, from as early as the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in 1948 to the more recent population conferences on health and women's status, the Cairo and Beijing conferences. And as you can see, other covenants in between that have to do with economic social rights, rights of the child, CEDAW, the Convention on Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, etc. So we did a thorough review of these documents, and these two slides show the specific articles within these documents that spoke in a manner that made the family cap policy, that was relevant to the family cap policy, and particularly where our family cap policy in the U.S. welfare system would be considered in violation or contradicting specific articles of these international documents. But what I should point out is that the asterisks next to some of these bullets indicate these international documents that we as a country have not signed on to. The glass half full or half empty view, depending on which you prefer, of some folks might be, well, we're not really in violation if we didn't sign on to these documents to begin with. But I think that's a whole other conversation. So, for example, differential treatment of children born to poor mothers, differential treatment of poor and non-poor women, economically coercive environments for women's reproductive decision-making, all, in our view, specifically spoke to what the family cap, in essence, does. And so, again, what we concluded from our analysis of the human rights documents was that this policy should be considered in violation of accepted human and reproductive rights tenets. So then in terms of primary data collection, we wanted to see what the experience of the family cap, sort of the on-the-ground experience, has been in this country, because we did look at some national data sets, but there's not a whole lot of information on the real on-the-ground experience, because with welfare reform, there was devolution to the states, and so federal or national oversight of welfare changed and essentially was intentionally limited from the mid-1990s, so that states had a fair amount of autonomy to create their own programs adopt policies if they saw fit to do so, and the ways in which they chose to implement them. So what we did is we conducted a state policy analysis by interviewing directly the state welfare directors who had primary responsibility, among other things, of the family cap programs in these states. We did a web-based analysis of documentation as well as in-depth interviews with these key informants, and we sought to ask the following questions. How have states varied in the implementation of this policy? What were these officials' attitudes regarding the policy's effectiveness, benefits, or disadvantages? And did these sort of state attitudes relate vis-a-vis state provision of family planning services, which actually ties into one of the points that Dr. Roy made in her first presentation? So these are 24 key informant interviews, for the most part, you know, it was a qualitative analysis of the content from these interviews. They were all conducted via telephone. And so the slides that will follow will report our findings on the status of the policy, evaluations, conducted or not, what these professionals' opinions were with regard to the policy itself, and whatever else we learned about other ancillary policies that the state had in place that might support or contradict the policy, the family cap policy itself. So in terms of the status of the policy, I mentioned earlier that up to 24 states had adopted it from early 1990s on up until really the 2000s, but since then five repealed it or essentially phased it out. Again, but still 19 states, this policy is alive and well. In terms of evaluations, I showed you already some of the literature that we reviewed on what appeared to be empirical evaluations of the policy, but as I said, many of them were not specifically around the family cap. That was sort of an add-on or included with a bunch of other things. So we asked directly whether these individuals who are running these programs were aware of any evaluations of the program or policy. And we had somewhere between 6 and 8 have knowledge or report that some evaluation had taken place. As far as their attitudes about the policy vis-a-vis whether the state had undertaken an evaluation or not, we got a wide range of responses, and just to give you a flavor of that, in New Jersey, the informant said that even though they recognize that, quote, until we see the data, we can't make a call, the informant mentioned, if I were a welfare recipient, the family cap policy would make a difference. So they conjectured, you know, in terms of what an individual's response might be to the policy. Idaho, when asked to explain their positive attitude toward the policy, the informant noted, my gut says that it's discouraging women from having babies. And I thought, you know, it was interesting to highlight that because we heard that a lot. And meanwhile, you know, we'd like to think that our attitudes or the attitudes of policymakers or administrators around particular policies might be informed more by what their gut says or what they think, but that they would be interested in having more empirical understanding of how a policy has worked or not. Florida, I would like to think that the policy would be effective in reducing the number of births in families given what it set out to do. So just because there's an objective there, an assumption that it's achieving it. And California informant stated that even though they did lack empirical evidence about the policy's effectiveness, they, quote, still have to believe that it does change women's behavior. Having data wouldn't hurt us, but it wouldn't necessarily change our minds. So that was a very clear admission that data didn't really drive whether or not there was continued support or belief in whether a policy worked or not. In terms of their own professional-based opinion about whether it was effective or not, taking a step away from whether evaluations had formally been conducted, as you can see, a majority felt that the policy was not effective. Some thought it was, and a few also weren't sure. So to give you, again, a flavor for where these folks stood on this, From Connecticut, the informant noted that taxpayers favored the policy because they believed that it prevented their federal and state taxes from being used to, quote, reward people for making poor choices. Oklahoma, the policy keeps the state legislature happy because it gives the political perception that they're not adding babies to the TANF caseload. Minnesota, the policy sends a message that, quote, the government won't pay clients for having more children. Illinois, those who support the policy might argue that a major benefit of the policy is its role in providing a, quote, lesson regarding personal responsibility to TANF recipients. In Virginia, they felt that the policy fostered personal responsibility. And North Dakota, an official explained there that it's a feel-good policy. It makes the state legislature and general population feel that at least some attempt is being made to alter TANF participants' reproductive behaviors. So when we looked, we also asked about other the ways in which the policy was being implemented to get a sense as to, okay, what might the experience then for TANF recipients be, those who are subject to the policy. It seemed that some states had adopted some ways to kind of soften the blow of not getting additional assistance by way of providing vouchers to the women for things that they could get to assist with a new child, but not, you know, real cash. And also Medicaid, some refer to Medicaid family planning waivers, but we note that these predate the family cap. This is the ability of the decision of states to increase access to contraception to poor and low-income women, and some states do and some states don't. In terms of what we felt were contradictory or unreasonable aspects of the policy or its implementation, child support payments, several states still collect or garnish child support payments for a newly born child in the household that's capped. So the family is not getting additional cash assistance from the welfare system, but they still are having child support garnished. In the case of a deceased parent, many states still would have a family cap policy in place. They might provide the additional assistance only if the custody of the child is given to a relative or a grandparent. Then the child can receive assistance. Applying the family cap not only to the woman, the mother in the household, but in some cases the state then carries on it on to a minor, a teen who might be pregnant, even if a separate household is established. It's sort of like grandfathering the family cap. And several states not having exemptions or exceptions for contraceptive failure. It was unclear. One policy that a number of states had adopted was this representative payee, where they would give additional cash, but just not to the mother. They'd give it to somebody else that they call a representative payee to act on behalf, you know, sort of the family and the child. One thing, removing agency from the mother, but still providing cash assistance that hopefully the mother and the child might receive. And finally, before I wrap up, I have here, this shows the states that have or have not adopted this Medicaid family planning waiver, which in essence, adopting it means that the state is providing additional support for women, poor and low-income women, to obtain contraceptives. And this is the split in terms of whether the state has a family. All of these are states that adopted the family cap, and it shows you which ones have the family planning waiver and which ones don't. So it's still kind of like a 50-50 split. You would think if they have a family cap in place, they would be more likely to adopt the family planning waiver to help, if they really want poor women not to have children, to help them in avoiding a pregnancy. So our conclusions from this work have been that essentially the family cap is still in place in the majority of states that adopted it. Very few formal evaluations of this policy have been conducted. Most of the people whose responsibility is to implement this policy have indicated to us that they don't believe it's effective. And there hasn't been an increase uptake or adoption of the family planning, the Medicaid family planning waiver, where one would think that that would at least be a way to increase the effectiveness of the policy, if that is a reasonable goal. in terms of advocacy policy focus going forward, welfare was supposed to be reauthorized in 2010. It's been put off even very recently, has been extended again. We're thinking maybe next year, not sure. And so we're trying to think about, from a public health perspective and what we do know, whether it might be more appropriate to seek a repeal of the policy, work with advocates and others around repealing it. At least maybe minimally a step down from that ask might be calling for at least mandatory evaluation of the policy. So there's no requirement from the federal government that states collect any data whatsoever or evaluate the policy. And then possibly even further step down, even if the policies are kept in place, I list there a number of ways that maybe states that have the policy in place might be able to, again, soften the impact of this policy, the negative impact of the policy on poor women and children by providing more exemptions, alternatives to this full cash exemption, taking up the Medicaid family planning waiver, et cetera. Thank you very much.